Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Unemployment benefits in the Senate, cold weather almost everywhere, and bonuses on Wall Street. Happy New Year, everybody. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace Podcast for Monday, the 6th of January. Great, as always, to have you with us. The Congress of the United States, the Senate, to be just a bit more precise, got back to work today. And right near the top of the legislative to-do list was whether to reinstate the emergency unemployment benefits that expired just before New Year's. And if so, how to pay for that without running up more debt. There's a key procedural vote scheduled in the Senate tonight, but herewith a truism of the federal budgetary mechanism. These kinds of deals don't always deliver the savings they promised. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Ganser starts us off.
The uncharitable call Congress's fancy budgetary footwork a shell game.
There's a con going on.
That's economist Donald Marin, a former economic advisor for George W. Bush, now at the Urban Institute. He says, okay, Congress isn't a bunch of cons, but its budget deals are pretty gimmicky. Like when Congress ignores a program's long-term costs, focusing only on short-term revenues.
So they'll show up and they'll appear to be helping to pay for whatever the program is you want to pursue, but it still means in the long run that we're going to lose money.
Now you see it, now you don't. That short-term thinking leads to itty-bitty deals, like the Senate's emergency unemployment extension, which would only last 3 months. Henrietta Trace is a budget expert at Height Analytics.
If it's only for 3 months, you can sort of slide it under the rug and you don't have to pay for it.
Just don't look under the rug. Some Washington wonks say these kinds of budget deals are inevitable right now. Harry Holzer teaches public policy at Georgetown. He says with some in Congress vowing to take huge bites out of the deficit, normal budget negotiations just aren't possible.
It often has to be a bit of a shell game to square with their very severe rhetoric on fiscal austerity right now.
So Congress gets to trumpet budget cuts, even if they vanish, with a wave of the hand. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Also on the Senate's agenda today, at some point, voting on whether to approve Janet Yellen to run the Fed come February 1st when Mr. Bernanke retires. All right, moving on. School children are home by the millions. Flights are grounded by the thousands. Wind chills are being measured in the negative double digits. Yes, the great polar vortex of 14 is making its mark on much of the country and the economy, because a lot of things that we take for granted day in and day out, from starting the car to turning on the faucet, were a little harder today. Marketplace's Amy Scott reminds us that when it gets this cold, stuff just doesn't work.
Jeff Cherwinka is used to working in extreme cold. He spent 6 seasons doing research in the South Pole. Now he's back at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where it was minus 17 this morning.
It looks like it's minus 9 Fahrenheit at the South Pole today, so it's actually colder here than it is at the South Pole.
At these temperatures, he says plastic and steel become so brittle they can break. Car batteries stop working.
So there's a lot of, little inconveniences, but if it's, if it's your car and it's not starting, then it's a big inconvenience, right?
At the high-tech end, electronics can fail. Kevin Gutnick with the Minnesota Department of Transportation says things got dicey today on a reversible toll road on the west side of Minneapolis.
It goes in one direction in the morning and another direction in the afternoon. And one of the gates on that quit working because of the cold.
Below ground, water mains break. Even sewers can freeze. Shipping slows down in the Great Lakes. Diesel fuel can congeal. Wilf Nixon teaches civil and environmental engineering at the University of Iowa.
Things just break when it's cold. And unfortunately, they're under more stress, and it's when you need them most, and it's when they're most likely to fail on you.
That includes humans, too. We don't work so well when it only takes a few minutes in the cold to end up with frostbite. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
There was a little bit of chill on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Another year, another big fine for J.P. Morgan Chase. The bank is expected to soon be paying out another $2 billion in criminal and civil settlements to the federal government, this time around for ignoring signs of Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme a number of years ago. That brings the grand total of fines JPM has paid in the past year to just about $20 billion. The markets aren't paying any heed, though. Shares up almost a half percent today. CEO Jamie Dimon is still there. The company is doing just fine, it seems. But is there a limit? Tim Fernholz writes for Quartz. Hey, Tim.
Hi, Kai.
This will likely be another big fine for J.P. Morgan Chase. It brings the total for the past 12 months in regulatory action from this company to $20 billion, which is a staggering amount of money. And yet business continues apace, it seems.
There is nothing that can stop America's largest bank, apparently. Certainly nothing in America's government that can stop America's largest bank.
Well, so what gives? I mean, the stock is up. Investors are happy. Jamie Dimon, the CEO, still has his job.
Well, you know, you can look at it from a couple different angles. You know, maybe it is the highest of the low bars. J.P. Morgan, as a bank, is still relatively stronger than its rivals, still the largest bank in the country. What I think to look for with Jamie Dimon is going to be the company's latest earnings report. Ultimately, on Wall Street, and I think among the investors in these banks, they're an amoral bunch in the strictest sense of that term. They do not care about the crime. They care about the stock price and the earnings.
Take yourself out, though, of being a guy who looks at this stuff for a living, who talks to people on Wall Street, who does the analysis, and into the shoes of somebody just looking at the American banking system 5.5 years after the crisis and this kind of behavior going on.
Well, I think, I mean, you do a double take, right? But the thing to keep in mind is this settlement and all the other huge settlements that we're talking about with J.P. Morgan were all things that happened 4 or 5 years ago. You remember Mr. Madoff was arrested in 2009.
Yeah, 5 years ago,
So it's hard to say if similar things are going on today, if they've cleaned up their act. And I think that's one of the reasons that prosecutors have reportedly opted for this deferred prosecution agreement. They're going to ask J.P. Morgan to really strengthen the controls that they supposedly put to watch out for things like Ponzi schemes or drug runners or any other kind of money laundering. And if they don't, you know, perhaps the DOJ will come back and say there are more consequences to this.
Speaking of the DOJ, the U.S. Attorney for the Southern District of Manhattan, Preet Bharara, has said he doesn't believe there's such a thing as too big to jail, that companies have to be pursued almost no matter the cost to the larger system.
I think that's a good thing for him to say. I think, you know, as far as Preet Bharara goes, he is becoming, I think, the face of, you know, enforcement on the banks. The question is whether that same sort of enthusiasm is felt in Washington at the DOJ headquarters, at the Treasury Department, where reporting has been a little bit more murky about how serious regulators are about really saying, look, if you are breaking the law, you're going to be shut down, or at least we're going to take actions that might result in you shutting down.
Is there a deterrent effect to these fines that J.P. Morgan is getting? Do you suppose other banks, big or not big, might see them and say, you know what, we really need to toe the line a little bit?
You certainly hope so. I can't imagine that any other of J.P. Morgan's competitors is looking at this situation and saying, boy, I wish it were me. but again, you know, it may take another, sadly, another recession to see what's going on. The saying is, you know, you don't know who's not wearing a bathing suit until the tide goes out.
That's right.
All of this, all of these crimes came up during the 2008 crisis. Whether or not the banks are keeping their noses clean now, we may have to wait until more bad news reveals who's out to sea.
Tim Fernholz, he writes for Quartz. Tim, thanks a bunch.
Always a pleasure.
The way I heard it, by the way, was you don't know who's swimming naked. Don't know who's swimming naked until the tide goes out.
Can I re-say that? Is that the right way?
No,
I
don't that's good. We'll leave it there. See you, man. Be good. Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
Here are two phrases most of us would probably rather not hear in the same sentence. Drinking water and treated sewage effluent. Lots of cities do it, though. Put those two together, I mean, because water's scarce and, you know, recycling is a good thing. And they can do amazing things with sewage these days. But still, almost no place has gone so far as to connect sewage pipes directly to the drinking water supply. Which gets us to Big Spring, Texas, a thirsty town in a very dry place. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Dan Weissman has that story.
Big Spring's a decent-sized town for West Texas. About 27,000 people, got its own Walmart, but no actual spring. That dried up almost 90 years ago. That's around the same time oil was discovered in West Texas. And it's dry here, but so is a lot of the state. And a lot of the state's been slammed by this monster drought in the last few years. So why is Big Spring the site of this big experiment? Well, here's one possible clue. In terms of customer satisfaction, local water supply didn't have a lot to lose.
Nobody drinks the water here. Nobody drinks it out of the faucet.
Hell no. No, we don't do that. It's too hard. It's nasty.
That's Mary Jo Ackerson and Terry Sanders. For a long time, people here have relied on filtered water. A lot of them, like Ackerson, have filter systems in their homes. And like a lot of other people, Sanders has been filling up jugs with filtered water at the water shop for 20 cents a gallon. He's using a self-serve machine on one side of the shop. And on another, Crystal Lopez's family serves this steady stream of drive-through customers.
Cars come through and we'll fill up their jugs and send them on their way. And that's my mom, right? You know, her and my little sister do the filling up the jugs.
Last year, that city water that everyone avoids started to include treated sewage effluent, which goes through a brand new $14 million system. Uses heavy filtration, disinfection, tons of testing. John Grant is that system's architect. He's general manager of the Colorado River Municipal Water District, and yeah, he drinks filtered water at home too.
We're not blessed in West Texas with really good quality water. It's got a lot of salt. I mean, that's all we got.
It's like the old joke about the bad restaurant. Food here is terrible, yes, in such small portions. Big Spring gets fewer than 20 inches of rain a year. And the air is so dry, water evaporates from the reservoir at three times that rate.
So we pretty much start out in the hole already.
And that's why Big Spring has to pipe its sewage, its super-duper treated, double-disinfected, triple-tested sewage, directly to the main waterworks. Sending it to the reservoir by way of the creek would be more traditional, and it wouldn't work.
If you put this water in a creek out here, it would evaporate. We're actually creating more water.
Grant's system recovers 2 million gallons a day. That's about 40% what Big Spring consumes. And he started planning it more than 10 years ago. So the past few years of, you know, super-duper drought just made that plan more urgent. Here's how bad it is. Nearest reservoir to Big Spring is currently 1.4% full, and it's not the lowest in the state. Texas voters recently approved $6 billion in new water projects. The current five-year plan doesn't include much potable reuse. But when that plan was created, Big Spring wasn't online yet. No one had gone first. Here's Robert Mace from the Texas Water Development Board.
So it takes, you know, somebody, some local entity, brave enough to try it out, and then everyone else is looking over the shoulder, you know. And then once they see it works, then boom, off everyone goes.
Right now, three more places in Texas are actively exploring potable reuse projects. There's the town of Brownwood, city of Wichita Falls, and the much bigger city of El Paso, with more than 600,000 people. But getting their citizens on board could be a tough sell. In Big Spring, where no one seems to drink the water, the reuse project flew under some people's radar. You know, about half the people I talked with there never heard of it. And that included Crystal Lopez at the water shop. And here's how she responded when I told her about it.
Really? I didn't know that. That's gross. That is gross. Wow.
I explained how good the filtering was. The same filtering process she uses in her shop, plus the decontamination, the testing, and the fact that lots of cities take their water from rivers that some other town has dumped sewage in. Yeah, no sale.
I don't know. That's disgusting. I can't even think of another word.
In Big Spring, Texas, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
Coming up.
It's definitely a time when we make the most money, and it's a great time to make a really good impression and then get all the people who are coming in to stay coming in.
The business side of your New Year's resolution, but first, let's do the numbers. Well, here you go. The Dow Industrials dipped 0.25% today, 44 points, closed at 16,425. The NASDAQ down 0.4%. That is 18 points there. Finished at 41.31. The S&P 500 backed up about 0.25%, 4 points, ended at 18.26. Financial firms went the other direction. Bank of America picked up 1.5%. Citigroup advanced 0.75%. Goldman Sachs added 0.67% today. Mixed bag for tech, though. Google shares ended the day more than 1% higher. Apple pocketed about 0.5%. But Intel erased more than 1%. Microsoft threw off more than 2% today. Twitter took a 4% nosedive after being downgraded by Morgan Stanley. Overseas, Britain's FTSE traded flat. The French CAC 40 forfeited nearly 0.5%. Yes, I try to speak French. The German DAX gave back just under 0.1%. Not a lot, though, which is why you rarely hear me do the DAX. The CAC, I mean. Bonds rose, the yield on the 10-year Tino, 2.96%. You're listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. The Institute of Medicine holds a workshop on the current state of obesity solutions in the U.S. The Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in November. And the Harlem Globetrotters played their first game on January 7th, 1927 in Hinckley, Illinois. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. And if you'll pardon the paraphrase, for the next week or so, what happens in Vegas will most definitely not stay in Vegas. The Consumer Electronics Show is once again upon us, the annual mega convention of all things technological. The tech industry and the show are known for promising us the future, even though the last time I checked, we're all still waiting for our jetpacks, aren't we? But it does turn out that the future may not be one of unimagined gadgets, but one of everyday objects with Wi-Fi. Marketplace's David Weinberg brings us the history of the future.
Benjamin R. Harrison was working at CES last year as a videographer for the website Engadget when he was ushered into a hotel room to see the unveiling of a prototype for a virtual reality headset that allows users to become the character in a game.
At that point, it was literally ski goggles that had components like duct taped into it.
Virtual reality, like jetpacks, was promised to us long ago. In this case, the duct tape ski goggle contraption became Oculus Rift, a virtual reality headset that's expected to deliver on the promise of virtual reality gaming. Roughly 20,000 new products will launch at this year's CES, but very few will be big commercial successes.
I think the way to think about this is as more of a case of evolution than things succeeding or failing.
Sean Dubravac is chief economist and head of research at the Consumer Electronics Association, which produces CES. He says many of the products unveiled this week will flop commercially. Often the first generation of a product is the crummiest and can take time for bugs to be worked out or for people to understand why it would be useful to them. Many of this year's new products are part of a larger technological trend.
Just the digitization of everyday things.
Dubravac says the future is one of sensorization, where everyday objects from toothbrushes to tennis rackets will have sensors that generate streams of data, like the speed of your backhand. The age of autonomy, as Dubravac calls it, is one where cars drive themselves and all of our things talk to our computer, so it can manage all the data generated for us by our new gadgets, which would free us up to enjoy those new gadgets. I'm David Weinberg from Marketplace.
We're coming up on one of the most eagerly anticipated times of the year on Wall Street, bonus season. The payouts are big, averaging six figures. Higher level bonuses can spiral into the millions. This year looks to be uneven. Some bankers doing well and others, especially bond traders, getting somewhat less. And even others, a lot more people than you might expect, getting a slice of it as well. Marketplace's Mark Garrison explains.
We are miles from the financial district, inside the busy kitchen of New York catering company Sonier & Castle. That sizzle is the sound of swine near the end of the line.
This is pork belly that we had cooked in duck fat earlier, and now we're...
Later, the glistening cube will be skewered, then passed around by an impeccably dressed young server at a very fancy party. The company's most elaborate dinners cost hundreds of dollars per person. Today, the team is prepping for an event for a famous fashion designer. Recently, it catered the movie premiere of The Wolf of Wall Street. Co-founder David Castle says the real Wall Street is critical to the company's bottom line.
A third of our business comes from the financial industry.
Castle says corporate entertaining hasn't fully recovered from the crash, but bank employees are spending again. That means their bonuses are more important than ever.
Bonuses would be great for us. It would definitely translate into bigger spending and to more hiring, more jobs.
His catering company laid off workers in the financial crisis, but with sales up 20% last year, Castle is hiring again. Full-time staff as well as part-time servers and cooks who rely on the extra income. From the owners to the dishwashers, the whole company reaps the benefits of Wall Street bonuses.
They're receiving income, and in turn, they turn around. They spend it.
That's what economists like NYU's Lawrence J. White call a multiplier effect. All that bonus money ripples across the entire economy.
The initial beneficiaries are the people who receive the bonus, but it doesn't stop there.
A big bonus banker orders a fancy steak dinner from a server who uses the big tip to splurge on new home furnishings. Everybody wins. As the old rhyme goes, the butcher, the banker, the candlestick maker. Okay, I did tweak it a bit. Speaking of candlesticks, there are rather nice ones in homes where Darren Hinault designs the interiors.
This is the library of a townhouse downtown for a wealthy family.
In his studio, he shows photos of rooms he created. They include the homes of some of the top people in finance. The rooms look stunning, like lush film sets. Clients pay him hundreds of thousands of dollars to perfect the insides of their multi-million dollar properties. When a banker's bonus comes up short, he knows.
I have definitely had people say to me, "I did not have a great year. Let's dial back again."
Chances are you don't care if a rich banker is less rich. But think about it this way. If a banker gets a larger bonus, he can give Hinault a bigger budget, which helps small businesses.
More people are involved in the making of the higher-end things than the lower-end things.
If that banker goes for pricey custom elements, a lot more locals are going to work.
A custom painter, a faux finisher out in Queens, there's a company that does hand embroidery. All these different sort of artisans are people that we would bring in, as opposed to stock items, which are being formed and spit out by machine.
And those giant bonuses are taxable, which means they help fix streets, pay cops, and fund programs low-income residents depend on. That's why New York politicians, even those on the left, rarely attack Wall Street pay. For regular people whose jobs depend on them, big Wall Street bonuses aren't excessive. They are absolutely vital. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
One type of business that should be doing some brisk business this month is your local gym or fitness center, all those people signing up after their big New Year's resolutions. Today, though, one and probably a whole lot more of those places are closed thanks to the weather. Revel Fitness in Carmel, Indiana does Zumba dance as a workout, and it's run by Robbie Huang. Robbie, it's good to talk to you.
Nice to talk to you.
I imagine, weather aside, this is your busy period, huh?
Yes, it is. January is always the busiest month for us.
So how do you scale? How does a small business like you, who probably has a regular customer base, deal with everybody wanting to come in and lose the poundage and sort of do a little detox?
Oh, well, it's actually just pretty much just all fun and games for us. The only thing that we see is just the bigger classes and more people. So we really don't have to do anything too much on our end, just be ready to teach classes and then have fun with the students.
So you cram more people into the dance studio? Is that the business model?
Pretty much. We find a lot of people, they make New Year's resolutions, and they really actually stick to them pretty well. We find that people keep coming starting in January, and then as far out as like April and May, people are still coming and sticking to their resolutions.
Really? April and May? Mine are done by, the 15th of January, and I'm out of there.
Well, I'm sure there's lots of people like that, but yeah, we find that our students really do that. And then we've got regulars who come throughout the year, even in the summertime and wintertime. So the regulars really keep us going strong. But when people make the resolutions, we do get a significant bump in the first months of the year.
All right. I should probably ask at this point exactly what Zumba is for those, including me, who don't know.
Okay, well, Zumba is basically an exercise program that combines dance moves, mainly Latin dance moves, and world music. It gives you kind of a workout that's more fun than just running on the treadmill or lifting weights. So it's really good for people who wouldn't normally exercise or who don't really like exercising. It doesn't feel like exercise.
Is this time of year sort of like Black Friday for retailers in that this is kind of the make or break thing for you and you make a bunch of your profit at this point?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, it's not make or break, but it's definitely a time when we make the most money. And it's a great time to make a really good impression and then get all the people who are coming in to stay coming in.
How much of a hit is this weather going to put on you? Probably a couple of days, maybe a week, and then you'll be back?
We're hoping to get open maybe by tomorrow, the day after. We got hit with the biggest storm that we've had in years. Yeah. And the wind chill is like negative 30 right now.
Which is, of course, the perfect time to go dancing in a nice hot gym, right?
Well, that's true if people could get their cars out of the driveway.
Well, yeah, there's that too.
Yeah.
Robbie Huang, he owns Revel Fitness in Carmel, Indiana. Runs it with his mom, as a matter of fact. Robbie, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, a moment to observe a long overdue bit of corporate rebranding in the new year. How many of you can tell me what EADS stands for? Not too many of you, right? Even though you've probably flown on their planes. Executives at the European Aeronautic Defense and Space Company have now apparently recognized the ungainliness of that name and have renamed themselves simply Airbus. No word on how many of those planes are sitting on the ground across this country today because of the weather, though. All right, we're done. That is Marketplace from APM on this Monday. Today, the Dow off 0.25%, about 44 points. The NASDAQ off 0.4%, 18 points. The S&P 500 dropped 0.25%. That is 4 points there. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Tommy Andres. Millie Jefferson directs the program. I am Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.